Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 554. And I'm joined this week by Kingsley Ben-Adir. Kingsley is an amazing actor. They play Bob Marley in Bob Marley One Love, which is out now. Perfect film to come out on Valentine's Day. It's a wonderful film. It's the story of Bob Marley. I was blown away by it. And I was really excited to talk to Kingsley because Kingsley was on the first set I ever worked on as an actor. And we've not really seen each other since then. So, you know, 8 years or so. So, yeah, I was really excited to get some time with Kingsley. Obviously, playing Bob Marley in the biopic of one of the most iconic singers and just people is huge. So, when I arrived and set up, I was told he's done loads of press today. He's a bit tired. So, you know, we'll do our best, but he might be running out of steam and so on and so forth. Not in the slightest. As soon as we greeted each other, we were good to go. So you're going to love this one. It's fantastic. And thank you for all the love for recent episodes. The David Holmes one last week in particular. What an astounding dude. And thank you for all the love for my return to music video directing. If you didn't catch it, head over to my YouTube. I directed a music video, a poetry video for a spoken word artist called Mathago. Now, I've not directed any videos like that in 8 years or so. But I saw Mathago perform supporting B. Dolan on his tour. And they just astounded me. And this particular piece, I really wanted to capture and get it out there and do anything I can to get as many eyes and ears on this piece as possible. So the reaction has been absolutely insane. So thank you all so much. Let's get on with the episode. As ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can buy my merch, support the podcast, and look good. You can support at patreon.com/scroobiuspip, where you can support the podcast. You may or may not look good. That's not my business. And head over to twitch.tv/scroobiuspip, yo, for all the fun and joy that's going on over there. There's loads of good stuff over there. If you're into my music, if you go on the videos section, there's a whole music section with live videos, all sorts of good stuff. All sorts of good stuff. You're going to have a lovely time. Speaking of lovely times, this is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 554 with Kingsley Ben-Adir. I'm here with Kingsley Ben-Adir. How are you, man? It's been a minute.
It has been a little while. I'm doing all right, man. I feel like I ain't seen you since when you came in on King Arthur.
Yeah.
Think that was it came out in 2016.
I think I bumped into you in the street a little while after it because it was a weird day. I bumped
Nick
into
Guy's
you
house.
And then I bumped, yeah. And then I bumped into Charlie somewhere completely else in London. It was just the most random of,
yeah.
And weirdly, the last time I was in this hotel, I bumped into Charlie for the first time in years. But
amazing.
Yeah, we worked on King Arthur and that was my first ever acting gig.
Wow.
And the amount I learned off yourself, off Charlie, off Aidan Gillen, Neil Maskell, Craig McGinley, it was an amazing cast, an amazing one to be part of. And Aidan in particular was one that, because on loads of my early scenes, I was kind of in the background, but so was he.
Mm-hmm.
And being aware how good he is, I was watching what he's doing when he's not doing anything, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a big lesson. So how was that for you, that project?
Because he was really focused, I remember.
Yeah.
You know, he was really quiet and calm and was thinking about his character in a way that was obviously, you know, he was putting the work in. Yeah, I remember his energy on that film. That film, I was in Thailand. I had Christmas New Year's in Thailand and I was enjoying it with my pals. And then I got a message from my agent saying, Guy wants to meet you. and you need to come back because he's only meeting, you know, Tuesday next week. And I was like, what? And, you know, I'd had a line or two in a couple of films, but it was massive. And I remember I flew back and then my flat was right next to Guy's house.
Right.
So I just had to walk downstairs and stroll over. And I remember we went up into the kitchen and we were just talking about life and music. And he was playing me some of your stuff, I think.
Oh, really? Yeah.
He was playing me some of your stuff and he was talking about wanting to get you on the film, but I don't think he'd reached out to you yet.
Or again, like, I'm not going to go into it too much because this is about you, but that was the maddest thing because literally the week they reached out and hit me up, I'd just decided, hadn't told the public, to stop doing music and try and get into acting.
Oh, nice.
And that week, I got a message off Guy Ritchie saying, would you be up for auditioning for...
And it's a real feeling. So we've just got some tea. We've got some English breakfast tea coming in.
Beautiful.
So we might hear a bit of clanging. Thank you, sir.
It's going to be an audio joy, this. It's going to be liquids, clangs.
No sugar. Can I be a pain in the ass and ask for a bit of milk?
Yes.
Is that all right? Yes. Thank you, bro.
So, yeah, that was a mad project, but you've been busy since then, man. You've been really busy. And there's a lot I want to talk about, and we won't fit it all in, but I was a big fan of One Night in Miami, of the OA, of Soulmates, my mate Brett Goldstein's show, Barbie's Secret Invasion, obviously. But as we won't fit everything in, we've got to start with Bob Marley, One Love, because that's what we're here to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel at this moment? Because all the creative work is done and it's about to come out.
Yeah, it's cut. The film's cut. They've locked it and people are watching it. And it's going to be, we've got the London premiere tomorrow and then Paris on Thursday, LA on next Tuesday. Then they've added a carpet in New York. They've added one in Miami that Rohan's going to do on the 9th of February. And then there's one in Washington, D.C. It's like, we started this, the sort of promotion and the tours, you know, we're a week in. And how does it feel, did you say?
Yeah. How does it feel?
It feels really nice.
Because a lot of work has obviously gone into this. I watched it, absolutely adored it. But again, the amount you must have had to put into this to play this role.
Yeah, it's two
such an important
it's
role.
2 years in March. In March, so once the film's out, it'll be 2 years I've got the job. And it's been an amazing experience, you know. And it was, what was incredible was that, you know, finding Bob or trying to find his voice, trying to find his humanity, you know, without sounding too pretentious, but like to try and understand who Bob was as a human being, like to try and understand like who he was as a father, you know, what Bob experienced on a personal level, on an internal level, to try and tap into that was only possible because I got to spend so much time with his family and his friends. I mean, I was, you know, within no time at all, I was in Jamaica with Bob's pals who knew him from when he was 12, 13. We was on Orange Street with Lego and, you know, and Lenny Dredd and Desi. And I was surrounded by his family, his friends, his colleagues, people who were there with him when he was writing the music. Like, I mean, I can't tell you how mad it was. I don't even think it's really even sunk in yet because it just became normal so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, there was no time to like celebrate getting the job. It was like, the family want you to do it. All right, cool. Right, there's a lot to do. There's a language to learn.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not Jamaican, so... And Jamaican patois, as far as I'm concerned, is a language, you know. It's not... Thank you. It's not like any... Just like a dialect, you know.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time listening to Bob because his daughter, Sadella, she sent me a wee transfer file one day out of the blue. And I opened it and it just went... And there was just like document and audio file. It just went on and on and on.
Wow.
And there was a note saying like, these are interviews with daddy that only we have. And we just want to share them with you. And I was like, oh my God, there is so much here to get through.
Mm.
So I just started, I didn't even know that was going to be the process, but I just, this is what I got to do. I got to start working through these interviews. And I started listening to Bob. That was all I did. I was just listening to him those first few months, listening and listening. And then I had to have a really honest conversation with myself and go, you know, I get about 80% of what he's saying. But there's a lot of Bob talk that I didn't understand.
Yeah.
And that's because it's a language. Jamaican patois is a language. It's not a dialect, you know. It's more than that. And to understand Bob, you got to understand the way that he talked. So the process for me, one of the major, major things was the language and kind of translating all of those interviews. And what was really interesting and scary was that it wasn't so much that I didn't understand. There were bits that I was completely misinterpreting. So I was misinterpreting things.
Right.
Bob would speak. I would type out what I thought he was saying. And then I'll bring Jamaicans over to my house, Jamaican people that I grew up with, to help me with the bits I didn't understand. And they'd be reading through what I typed out. And he said, you know, he's not saying that, he's saying this. You know, he's not saying that, he's saying this. And so my mind was just being blown. And I was like, okay, cool. This has to be the focus now. I need to make sure I understand everything Bob's saying in every single one of these fucking interviews that his children have sent me. And it required a lot of help, you know. There's no film without the family, and there's no film without Bob's friends. That's what's different about this. Yeah. It's not like, oh, thank God the family were there. It's like, no, this is a film that's produced by the family. It's produced by Rita and Ziggy, and Bob's close friend and artistic director, Neville Garrick. He was there with us every day.
It must have been amazing, though, right? To be welcomed into all of this, to drop yourself straight in and become part of this family and part of this world, essentially.
Yeah, it was. I really, honestly, when I look back, I did not take the time to, like, celebrate or even acknowledge how surreal what was happening was.
Yeah.
You know, there were moments in Jamaica where I'd look at Ziggy and I would just blur out and have these like out of body experiences where I go, oh yeah, you're Bob's son, you know, and then I'd have to get myself out of it and back to work and focus. And I remember one day, Ryan, Stephen, Ziggy, and, you know, a lot of the family turned up and we were in Trenchtown, we were doing a football scene. I got really emotional because I saw all of his kids standing there, and you just have these moments where you remember what you're doing and who you're playing.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, we wouldn't have been able to, there's no film without the family, and my process was with them, included them. I learned about Bob through his friends and family. And, you know, normally when you're playing a character, you figure out the character on your own in your bedroom and you come up with all your ideas. But like, this was different. I needed to understand Bob's vulnerability. You can't read books, you know. His public persona in all of the interviews that are on YouTube can only get you so far.
Mm.
There's just so many layers to him, you know. He's a tough, they called him the tough gung.
Yeah.
And they called him the skip. And they called him the general, you know. And when he was in the studio, he was, you know, he was heavy on discipline and work ethic. And I heard the creation of that album was very intense. They all nearly died a few months before.
Wow.
You know, gunmen went into Hope Road and fired shots, and they nearly all lost their lives. And there's a lot of trauma in that I think was transferred into the creation of the album. And that's when it became really interesting to me. I was like, hang on a minute. These guys, you know, they just nearly died. They had to flee. And then next thing, Bob's in London and there's this outpouring of emotion and truth and clarity that he's having. And I don't think it's a coincidence, you know, that his greatest work, you know, arguably, happened right off the back of that. So, yeah, I can't remember what your question was.
No, this is amazing. And again, it's really interesting to hear this, the level of the insight and the process, even the unexpected process, as you say, you didn't necessarily know that this was going to be the process. I want to kind of ask how playing this role has affected you as a person, because when we do find roles and find characters, we can go deep, we can research a lot, but characters like Bob and Malcolm X, so much of their personality is based on their political belief, their passions, their true, you know, real beliefs in how society should be, how mankind should be. So when you're going deep into that, I kind of wonder how much of that is eye-opening to you, changes your way of seeing things and thinking. So yeah, how's Kingsley come out of this?
I know exactly what you mean in that, you know, what Bob did and what he achieved, you know, as it relates to his music and his message and the responsibility of, you know, he had, you know, what he did in terms of, you know, how he affected people and how people looked to him to, you know, what he did in Jamaica and bringing the opposing political parties together and all of that.
I think there's an argument that there's not a musician who's had a more remarkable political impact. Yeah. And again, I forgot about that kind of until I was watching the film, because I grew up around reggae. My uncle was the first label manager of Trojan Records. So reggae was always around, but to much of the UK, reggae was about a vibe and a feel, because we didn't necessarily understand all of the patois and didn't know the conflicts and struggles that were being talked about in it. But of reggae, particularly Bob, is political music. And that's what I loved about the film, was it was going, oh yeah, it's about a musician, but it's about more than that. It's about where Jamaica was at that point and all of those things.
You know, when I started, like, I started really working through the catalogue of music from the beginning, Concrete Jungle, and just stopping every time I didn't understand what Bob was saying or I didn't understand the lyric. And it was a lot, you know, and I had help, and I now understand the full meaning of all of the songs. Yeah. And, you know, there was a day where I went, Bob's talking about God in most of his music, you know, even in jamming, when you get to the final verse, it's like God permeates spirituality, you know. He was on a mission, you know, and he was really trying to spread the message of his Imperial Majesty, you know, Haile Selassie, and what Bob's religion meant to him. You know, I feel like, going back to your question before, I think, how have I come out of this? I feel like trying to understand Bob as a human being and as a person and as a father, I had to really check what my relationship to, you know, safety, you know, safety, inner peace, kind of self-love, togetherness, self-togetherness. Those themes all work on an external level as well. So world peace, all of us coming together, unity of nations, all of that. But you flip them and you turn them inside and you go, where was Bob at in terms of inner peace during this period of time or during his whole life? Like, where did Bob, like, where was he at with feeling safe? You know, and then we're starting the movie with a shooting where he nearly died. So I just felt from the beginning that to attempt to try and kind of understand Bob on that level or to meet him at that place, I needed to check those things for myself. And I hadn't checked all of them. You know, I hadn't checked my relationship to safety. I hadn't checked the way that kind of I can respond badly in certain moments. I never really checked what, you know, my relationship to overworking is. I never checked really, you know, how I can really not trust people in many ways. It's behavior that I've been behaving a certain way my whole life. And it's hard to see yourself sometimes because you've normalized, so much behavior is normalized, not having boundaries, you know, like whatever our own versions of those things are really important to understand if you're going to attempt to play anyone, really, but particularly Bob, because what I found out, I can't remember how much I knew about Bob before I got the job, because I feel like I know him so well now. But Bob was from the ghetto. So when people say, like, everyone has an idea of who Bob is, and when you're playing someone, you really have to stop sometimes and just acknowledge the really, really simple facts. I went to Trenchtown, of course I did, and I was around there. But, like, just to stop and go, right, he was from the ghetto, and look where he went on a journey, man. Mm. He went on a journey that is so incredible. Where he got to in terms of music, I had a singing teacher before who told me, do you know how hard it is to write one hit song? Just one. You can spend your whole life writing songs and you probably won't write a hit song. So Bob wrote hit after hit after hit after hit after hit. Even the songs that, you know, weren't hits, I play them now and they would have been hits, you know, like hits. And even his bedroom tapes, you know, I listened to so much Bob, you know, so many Bob songs that never got released. Mm. So, like, things that he was working on, Jailbreaker and Jump Them. And I don't think those songs got released. The families, they didn't release them. And they became my favorite songs. I was like, this guy was up before the sun came up every day writing music. His commitment and his work ethic it didn't surprise me, but it's astonishing when I check it. Like, these are the things that, you know, I don't know how many of the fans know these kind of things, you know, like, so I just really enjoyed understanding, you know, what he was like as a person and to hear it from people who were there at the time. And remember, you know, everyone was, I was like, what's Bob like when, you know, during this time when they were creating Exodus in London, like, what was he like? I'd ask Neville. And he said, it's intense, man. He said, it's intense. I was like, yeah, no shit.
Yeah.
No shit, you know. He was like, yeah, he was on it, you know. He said, Tyrone told me, You know, there'd be weeks that go by where he wouldn't smoke, you know. So he was just, I think he'd probably had a feeling that was so strong that he wanted, you know, that there was this outpouring of emotion and honesty and truth, and like something really happened, you know, when they were making that album. Yeah. It's an amazing album. I don't think there's an album I've listened to more than Exodus now, you know, like it's, yeah. So yeah, just checking in on safety and peace, inner peace.
I love that. And again, it's worth highlighting again, you mentioned the hit after hit after hit and the size of the hits. It really can't be over-exaggerated that these were global hits, and they were of a genre that didn't have a global audience at the time. And like, it's like comparatively now you have people like someone like Getz, who's a superstar in the genre, but hasn't necessarily had the pop hit or whatever else. And then you've got when Dizzy first came through, or Stormzy or whomever else, that then get just global eyes on these things. And it's amazing.
But they'll all call out Getz, won't they? If you ask 100%. Them, you ask Kano and all of them, who's your top three?
Yeah.
They'll all say Getz.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. So it's that interesting thing there that it's one thing to make a hit within your genre, but it's another thing to make the hit that takes your genre out to more and more people. And then again, if you're doing it right, you're then shouting out those who should be known world over. As I said, you'll hear, when I had Kano on the podcast, Getz was one of the first people we talked about.
Yes,
exactly that. He's the rapper's rapper. So
yeah.
But yeah, it's astounding. I want to know what your upbringing was like. You grew up in London, right?
Mm-hmm.
And family, Trinidadian?
Yeah, my grandma and granddad on my mum's side, they came over from Trinidad in the late 50s or early 60s. But my grandma came over a little bit before, and then my granddad came a little bit after. Yeah, and then my dad's parents are both from here.
Yeah.
So my dad's white, and then... My mum's parents are from Trinidad and Tobago.
So what was your route into acting and entertainment and this kind of world? Was that always the goal, or was it there other things you wanted?
No, in year nine, I hope this ain't too boring, but in year nine, before the summer holiday, I was told that I wasn't going to be allowed back into year 10 unless I spoke to a counsellor and did, can't remember what it was, like there needed to be some serious intervention. I wasn't like one of the kids that was like, he needs to be expelled, you know. But they were just like, this is too much now. You're not actually going to make it through. I didn't do any work. So like, I remember I got to the end of year nine. I swear to God, I did not have one textbook with writing in it. I just should turn up, sit there, wait, go to sleep. You know, if you had a really strict teacher, I'd pretend I was doing something. But as soon as the lesson was, I was out. It was about socializing and being out and clothes. And just wasn't focused, you know, like wasn't interested in school. And I don't know what happened that summer. I just made a decision at 14. I was like, I want to go back and be good, you know, like I want to try. I don't know. I can't remember why it happened. I think I spoke to a kid who I'd grown up with who was doing really well at school. And there was something I envied a little bit and wanted for myself. So I started learning when I was 15. I was starting from scratch, really. I didn't have any real education, you know.
Yeah.
I could read and write a bit. Of course I could, but I just didn't try. And then I'm getting back to the question. No, I ended up randomly in a drama club because all my subjects got picked for me. Because I just was like, makes no difference to me. It was DT or art or... Like, I'm not very good at maths, but we all got to do maths. So I really, it was random and a coincidence that I got put into drama, and we just had a great teacher. And I met him in September, that when we started, and he was an amazing teacher who just joined the school pretty much the year before. And I started, you know, and I was on my own road to trying to get a little bit better. And it was the only subject where I was like in the top three or four people who were like the best at it.
And that makes a difference.
And it makes a difference because you go like, I could never be the best in English because I'm surrounded by guys who are really good at it.
Yeah.
But drama, everyone was kind of starting from scratch and, you know, it just kind of went from there. And then I left it, you know, I did it at A level. I stayed and did it at A level and just really enjoyed it. Every other term, there'd be a play that we were working on that I kind of liked or connected with. And I remember being 17 and reading a scene from A Raisin in the Sun. And I remember it making me cry as I was reading. I was just in the corner on my own, like trying to go over the lines. And the words obviously affected me. I didn't know what was going on at the time, but I was reading it and then I choked. And and then just around that time, I was watching films and collecting DVDs and just I didn't even know what I was doing, man. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just like, I like this thing and I'm going to keep watching and learn. I remember watching films, like classic films, and getting to the end going, I don't know what's going on, you know, I don't know what it was about, but I just know that I want to be a part of this. Yeah. Like, whatever this is, I want to be a part of it.
Oh, there's a beauty in that. I remember talking with Carsten, the director, Des Hamilton, and we were talking, because I came into acting with no prior training and that, and we were talking about the risks of getting the right training, because if you get bad training, you're going to be a certain way. And he was saying, one of the things he was saying is saying, if you want to learn how to act, go to a gallery and look at some art.
Yeah.
It's like, just see what moves you, because it doesn't have to be all explained and understood. It's just, you'll know what grabs you. And that could be the case with great film. You might not be able to articulate it afterwards, but you're like, that was amazing. I want to do stuff like that. Yeah. I want to be involved in that.
And some of the great actors and actresses now, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and never went to drama school.
They
never trained, you know, and they're killing it.
Yeah.
You know, so it just, I guess there's all different kinds of routes you can take. And I got to, you know, like 20, and I stayed at the school that I went to, and I worked with kids there. I was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And so I spent 2 years working with kids with behavioral problems and learning difficulties. And I really, 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 I loved it, man. The days went so fast. I found it was a joy. And I was still half a kid myself.
Yeah.
And I felt like I understood them. And I remember I got put in charge of like this group of boys who were, they were bottom set English, and there was no concentration there. I guess on some level as well, you know, kids are only behaving like that because there's trauma at home, you know. There's trauma at home. They haven't been taught how to learn. They haven't been taught how to focus or concentrate. It's not for everyone. And I really got that. So we'd sit in the I'd sit in the library with them, and I'd do one question. We'd do one question, and then we'd chat for 10 minutes about anything you want. And then do one question, we'd chat for 10 minutes. And then that would go on for an hour and a half. And then by the end, they'd all done 7 questions. And I was like, that's better than no questions.
Yeah.
You know, and it really worked with them. It really worked with them. And I really, really loved it. And then one of the boys I looked after, called Rufus, his dad was an actor at the RSC. And I had a really close relationship with Rufus's parents. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with them. And I said that, you know, how'd you get into this drama school thing? And he said, there's a lady called Hillary. She used to run Webber Douglas. She does acting classes at the top of this pub every Wednesday with these students who were at Central. And anyway, I can't remember exactly what the details were. Yeah. She said, if you get there at 9:30, she'll help you with your drama school auditions. So I used to go and meet Hillary at 9:30 in like Kensington somewhere. And I did a picture speech from Richard II. For some reason, I don't know why, and a speech from Chekhov. I did my modern, I did Chekhov. I was like, I'm not doing like a modern. I wanted to do Chekhov. I just had an interest in it. And then she coached me through, and and she really got me into, she got me into drama school, and then I went to drama school. So, yeah.
I love it. It's interesting. Again, it feels like it was important for you to make that choice at 14 that you wanted to learn and dedicate yourself to something rather than continue to feel you're being forced in a certain direction or whatever else.
Yeah, just being stuck, you know.
Can make a big difference. It's when you have that moment of, you know, I want to do this. I'm not here because I have to be.
Yeah.
I do have to be, but I want to make the most of it.
Yeah, I probably just needed some. I wanted to be praised, or, you know, I wanted to be seen. I mean, I was smoking so many cigarettes and drinking, and I'm 14. Like, what's all this about? When I look back, I go, if I see a 14-year-old doing some of those things, I'd be like, that's something wrong there, you know. It is normal to a point for kids to want to. But I was addicted to cigarettes at that age, you know. Like, I was, I just wanted to feel some sort of change. And I feel mad lucky that I found something that interested me, you know. Like, it's really saved me at so many different points.
Yeah,
you know, having something that I can always go to, you know.
It surprises me to hear you weren't like studious as a kid, because I think particularly when you take on characters that are established like Bob Marley and Malcolm X, I think there has to be a real level of research and a real level of deep dive. It's not purely your interpretation. I remember when we were on King Arthur, I remember you were reading Sam Cooke's biography.
Yeah.
Because again, I think you were looking at or up for playing Sam somewhere. And
good memory.
The amount of, again, it struck me because I was like, as it was my first acting gig, I'm like, right, all I can do is focus on trying to get my small role right and try and make it good and do the best I can. But the fact that people were nailing that, but finding any minute they can to still work forward, improve themselves rather than, I always remember on a gig, someone saying to another actor, you're kind of I know this is your first gig, but you're treating it like it's your only gig or your last gig rather than this is a career. Like, treat it right, but you should remember that this, or at least tell yourself that this is what you're going to be doing forever. And again, I think that's an important thing. Yeah. I love people who have that focus on that constant improvement and constant process. But yeah, I guess how do you find the studious area of researching characters like this?
Well, have I mentioned, sorry, because the first thing, when you said there, you got treating it like it's your last job,
as opposed to
treating it like this is something you're going to be doing.
Yeah.
I think they can both be valid.
Yeah.
I think I always try now not to take it for granted, like, to go, this could be my last job.
Yeah, you know,
this could be my last job. And, you know, and I don't know why psychologically for me that helps me in some way. But then at the same time, you have to trust that. Lashana was just saying it earlier, you know, like visualization and things like that. And you have to be really clear, you know, if you want to do something that's heavily oversubscribed, too many people trying to be actors, like your chances of making it are really low. Then there is a kind of visualization that's a part of it as well. And you have to be very clear and in your mind, you have to see your career and all of that. So I think they both kind of work,
depending
on, you know, where you're at and what's good for you. But I find it very, very easy to switch on into like a kind of overdrive when I'm interested in something. And it works the other way. When I'm not, I can't. I don't know if that... I got an ADHD diagnosis when I was at drama school, but I never really paid any attention to it. It was just interesting to know. I was going to say,
that hyperfixation is so naturally neurodivergent minds. And again, it's finding that way to make it a superpower rather than a weakness as such. It's like, right, no, this means that when I am into something, I can go deep on this. And
I've always found that, even from King Arthur and Sam Cooke, I'm like, boom, there's an opportunity here. I'm happy to do whatever I need to do to try and learn as much as I can. But I think equally, growing up now and getting a bit older, if I look back at the experience of filming Bob Marley, I go, well, if I could have done anything different, I would have taken a few more breaks.
Right.
I would have taken a few more breaks, and I'm really going to try and concentrate on that the next job I do, because actually you can overwork sometimes and you can just be working from a place of anxiety and you know, like, to get to a place where you are working productively and looking after yourself at the same time. Like, I'm so happy and proud to have been a part of this project, but there was a part of me that got to the end and go, well, you couldn't do this 3 times a year.
Yeah.
You couldn't do this 3 times a year physically, your health, your sleep.
It's the Mark Wahlberg posting his workout routine. It's like, that's good if, like, he posted this workout routine at some point. It's like, that's viable if you're getting in shape for a specific thing. That's not viable for your life.
For your life.
You can't be getting up at 4 a.m. every day doing your first workout, then doing this, then doing
you
that.
Crash and burn.
It's cool for what you need to do, but don't put that out there as a, here's what you need to do to
I agree. And really, football was amazing during filming Bob, because for some reason, you know, part of my, I remember my Google calendar, I've just put all the Arsenal games in, and it was like, it was 90 minutes or, you know, a bit over with halftime, and where I was able to switch off and play. And I think probably because I knew how much Bob loved football. So I felt like it was something I could do that was still connected to him in a way.
It's kind of work. Yeah. It's tax deductible.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what I mean? But
I
used to have that. It's weird you mentioned that. I had that for a period with FIFA, the game, because I was like, that will mean I can't be looking at my phone and checking my emails for X amount of time. I've got something I'm focusing on, and I might have a podcast on, I might still be learning something in the background, but it was that thing of not constantly being, what do I have to be doing next?
Yeah.
How am I getting this next role. Why isn't the phone ringing? What more can I be doing to get this and get that?
Yeah,
and
doing. Bad. Yeah, someone said something. We spend a whole bunch of time doing, and not enough time just being. I'm getting better. I love to chill as well. So I'm good at chilling. I can chill 3-4 months. I'm like, I'm good. I'm so happy.
Oh, what do you like to do? What's your go-to kind of, like when a job's over, what you like is...
Mad, that's just simple things that I just bought. I like taking the pace off the day.
Yeah.
So I'll write a small list of things to do and then I'll take 7 hours to do them.
Yeah.
And I feel like, do you know what I do mostly? It's really me and my boys, we're all on WhatsApp groups and we just go, who's meeting at the Lido tomorrow? I think we've tried to flip it a little bit so we don't go out and drink so much anymore. It's really, we meet up and we go to the Lido and we jump in the cold water first thing in the morning and then we'll have some breakfast and then maybe just go for a walk around the heath and catch up. And it's really amazing because you do that first thing in the morning, you feel great, and it's a great way to see people. I think the last 2-3 years, I've been so busy that a lot of time can pass and you haven't seen people. So I feel like the last little while, my life's just been about work and thinking about work and stuff like that. So I'm just always trying to find the gaps to take a day or two to just switch off. But after this tour, I'm going to do some proper chilling, you know, and just enjoy doing nothing, you know. And
I think like morning cold water swims are like a burrito or something, right? So you just say a burrito, it's like this simple thing, but actually there's so many different things in it that make it this thing. And you say, I'm going to get up and early and go for a swim, but you're getting up early and you're waking yourself up on one thing. When I used to do it, I'd jog down there. So I'm getting this little bit, I'm waking my body up.
And do you go to Ladder on the Heath?
No, I used to go in Margate.
Okay,
in the sea. In the sea. Yeah. And they have a seawater Lido there. So it's just, it doesn't matter about the tide.
Nice.
The water's already in. And it'd be that thing of jog down there and you're waking yourself up. Going in, again, I'm just such a big believer of getting in cold water. Yeah. I think it's so good for your body and
it's
mind.
The best,
but then also you're adding the fact that you're now firing on all cylinders at this early point in the day and you're seeing the sunrise or you're hearing the birds sing. Like if it's at a heath or something like that, you're experiencing nature. So it's easy to say a morning swim.
Yeah.
But there's so many ingredients in there that make it so much more impactful.
Do you know what? After lockdown, it's become like a thing. So cold swimming's become a thing. And I have to say, me and my pal, we clocked it early. So it was years, it was like just after King Arthur times, really.
Yeah.
We would jog, we do New Year's Day jogs on the heath. We'd meet up and do a jog and then he parked the car up by the men's pond. And so we finished the jog and we're getting in the car and we see all these people jumping in. And we was like, oh, should we go and do that? What the hell are they doing? Do you know what I mean? They're all jumping, it must be freezing. And we jumped in and I swear to God, I was like, wow. It was, I mean, you know, you stay in there too long, you're banging trouble. You know, I got hypothermia the other day. I stayed in too long. I come back, I think I didn't have much body fat on me at the time. And I did 12 lengths in like, I think it was like 9 or 10 degrees. And I was just getting into it.
Yeah.
The last length, I felt euphoric. It was like almost like, it was almost like an MDMA feeling. And I remember I got this rush of positivity and all these things that I was going to do and all these things that I was going to fix and I was going to mend. And then I got to the end of the length and I got out the pool and I wobbled. And then Maxine, who works at the Lido, she said, are you all right? And I was like, no, I don't think I am. She said, come sit down. And listen, I've been there when people are getting dragged out the pool and wrapped in those blankets and all of that. And I kept bugging in and out. So like she was saying things and I was talking like really, really fast. And then I didn't know where I was and she was saying something and I couldn't remember what I'd just been saying. So they took me into the room and I was in the room for an hour. They wrapped me in like 7 blankets and warmed me up. And I'm just yapping the whole time.
Yeah.
It's such a kind of joyful feeling.
Yeah.
But you're freezing, your organs are just about to shut down.
Yeah.
And like it was scary, you know, because it's that, you can get that close. You know, I didn't, you know, you got to respect the water as well because, you know, it's...
Well, that's one of the things I've learned. Like, I've been doing it for years and I just love going out there. I love being in it. I don't tend to overdo it. But then a couple of years back, as you said, it's got more popular. And my mum started doing it, right? And she joined a group called the Blue Tits. And it's like for women to go
these
early morning... This is in Southend.
Okay, cool.
They all meet up and they go for a swim. And I think a Blue Tits is like a national thing and people can sign up. But She sent me a couple of videos that are their kind of advice things. I learned tons of stuff that I didn't know.
About
I've
how
just
to
been getting,
go,
yeah, yeah, like again, the fact that, like, for starters, you shouldn't rush in because you should go in gradually because your body then adjusts and your heart rate acclimatizes and all this. Whereas if you jump straight in, it's shock. I'd always thought you get straight under as quickly as possible, but that's shock and that can put you into hyperthermia and things like that. So there was all these small things that I was like, man, I'm such an idiot that I've just been going, just go and have a swim.
Just go, jump, like, just go and jump
fine.
In. Yeah,
but as you say, you've got to respect.
Yeah. One of my pals, he goes there and he just stands still.
Yeah.
So he just goes up to his neck.
Yeah.
And he closes his eyes and he just does the Wim Hof breathing.
Yeah.
I like to move and get a little bit of swimming. They got a sauna there now as well, so you can jump straight in that, warm up, and then do the hot to the cold, to the hot to the cold.
I had Wim on the podcast about 6 years ago. I went to his house in the Netherlands.
Oh, wow.
I swear I'm driving there. And as I get closer, everything gets colder and icier. And by the time I get there, he's like, his pool is frozen over and all this. I'm like, it was proper, pure chance on the weather, I'm sure. But it's proper, like, I'm visiting someone special here.
Yeah.
But I love the stuff. But I'm similar. I learned a lot of that stuff. I didn't connect with it massively. I don't know how much I believe in it, but I'm big on the kind of taking control of your breaths and being controlled and slow. And then, move about or float about.
Yep.
But anyway, let's get back to acting. But before we talk a little bit more about One Love, I want to talk a bit about One Night in Miami because I thought it was so good. And it felt like a breakout role for you. It felt like that got Love Eyes. But it was a weird one for me because I also felt it got overlooked a bit because it was in that first wave of stuff made for streamers that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was a fair bit of stuff made for streamers that was quite throwaway and all this. And that was one of the first ones that I was like, this is amazing. And for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, the one line kind of reads almost as like a joke, but because it's essentially Sam Cooke, Cassius Clay, Jim Brown and Malcolm X walk into a bar as such. Mm-hmm. But it's them in this hotel room on this one night and it's just a conversation really. Yeah. But
they did go
in. It's amazing, yeah.
They did go in and there was a video of Cass at the time, the morning after.
Yeah.
When he comes out. And if you watch that video when he's talking to the press, you're watching a young man who isn't in a good space.
Yeah.
For someone who's so normally vibrant and charismatic and funny and, you know, his sense of humor. And he, for me, watching it, I was like, he's rocked. So I was like, something did happen in that room. And Kemp really, you know, it's so imaginative. It's so imaginative to create a conversation that may or may not have happened.
But to have those characters to create a conversation with is like, the writer must have just been, this is heaven. I've got these four of the most amazing characters you could wish to have. And then now I get to write this explanation.
Yeah, and I felt like the drama really, or the so much of it relied on the energy of the performances, because where it peaks and where it troughs and how to build the energy throughout. Really, the peak is the conversation between Malcolm and Sam when they come back down from the roof.
Yeah.
So it was really about layering and balancing. And really, my intention was, I was cast just before Christmas and we were starting on the 4th of January. For whatever reason, it was a last minute casting and I came in and there was a couple of us who were auditioning and I got the part and I had just over 2 weeks to get ready.
Wow.
And so...
And that's a pressure role as well. Malcolm X is
great in a way because I didn't have time to think.
Yeah.
I didn't have time to overthink.
Straight
I just
to
had
work.
To, yeah, straight to work. Got to use every minute of every day to train. And I was like, we could be... You know what it's like on films. You can shoot... You're shooting out of order.
Mm-hmm.
So you could shoot the last scene on the first day, the first scene on the last day, the middle scene. Like, it could be anything. So I said to myself, you need to learn this. Like, it's a play and you're going out to play it and to turn up on that first day, that table read with no script, off the book, in character. I want to show Regina that I can, and the producers and all of them, anything to do with your schedule, don't worry about me. I can jump in it because we were doing the roof and we had to work it around rain and stuff like that. And I'm going to put a script in front of me. I just put it down on the floor. I think I bumped on two lines and then off we went. And I had the most exhilarating acting experience of my life.
Yeah.
I came off of that job high as a kite. I wasn't concerned about the result. I wasn't concerned about how well it was going to do or what it was going to do. I was like, I have had an experience with an incredible director who trusted me and directed us and just brought the best energy to set every day. I had an experience. That's what I learned for the first time. Like, it doesn't really matter after you've rapped, you know?
Mm.
When you rap, you've rapped. You've done your bit. That's it. You've done your bit. Unless you want to get into producing and editing and doing all of that as an actor, you come in, you're of service for 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 3 months, whatever it is. And one night in Miami for me was that. It was just so intense. And when you nail a scene, it's a good feeling. And spending that much time with Malcolm, listening to him and watching him, it's a joy. It's a joy. Yeah. Same way with Bob.
Yeah.
You know, I can listen to, I've been playing Bob this morning, you know, it's like, so as a treat. And you know, when you're starting out, you dream of opportunities like that, and then they happen, and you got to meet it and be ready. And one night in Miami was just a joyful, an experience that really changed me as an actor. And I don't know why, for many reasons, but the experience was awesome.
Who do you read and rehearse with? Because again, it's interesting. I think if you're wanting to go in completely off book,
mm-hmm.
did you have someone that you're working with on that to get ready?
Yeah, I messaged, there's a young actor called Alex Moffat, who's brilliant. And he was at the secondary school when I was working there. And he applied to drama school maybe 5-6 years later. And you know, was asking me for advice and stuff like that. And so we kind of stayed in touch. And I gave him a little bit of advice about his speeches and all of that stuff. And I knew he was just graduating. And I said, look, I'll give you 150 quid a day or whatever if you can come and just run this with me.
Yeah.
And he just got his first theatre job, or he was going away or something like that. And he said, I can't do it, but I've got someone who I trained with.
Right.
His name's Andy, and he'll help. So this random kid come around to my house. And he's not a kid, he's 25.
Yeah.
And then off we went, man. We just ran the scenes. And he's an actor as well. So he was really helpful in that way. In fact, I think he came over to help me with the first audition. And, you know, and he helped me with Bob and Barbie and all of that. I think a verbal processor, someone said, or something like that. I have to say things out loud and talk things out for them to sink in.
Yeah.
So yeah, and yeah, we ran it. We ran the whole film from start to finish, you know, a bunch of times before the new year. So I had it up on its feet in my flat, you know. And
love it.
I didn't like get set on everything.
Yeah.
But I made sure I had four or five ideas for different moments, and you know, the big speeches in the middle with Leslie and stuff. So yeah.
I mean, it's the perfect one to do that with, right? Because it is all based largely, obviously there you do move around, but it's all based in one room mm-hmm. as such. So it's the perfect one to really get tight and know, you know, what your performance is and how you want to put this out there.
And the script weren't changing because it was good, you know. The language wasn't going to change. Like a lot of jobs, you know, things are being rewritten as you're going, and you got to stay like, you know, you got to stay a bit nimble.
I remember the panic on King Arthur, right? Because like, again, my first acting gig, and I've got a stutter. I've never played a character who's got a stutter, but that just means I do a lot of prep. I figure out where I'm going to breathe. I really nail all this stuff. And we're doing the first scene that I've got dialogue in, and we do it once. And there's a load of us, and guys like, I don't know if this is working, and gets us all together. It's like, let's rewrite it. And we're rewriting it there. And I'm thinking, this is number one. I'm thinking, this is amazing that I'm being trusted to give input, and we're having this amazing process. But then when we get back in our positions, and again, I ended up being cut out of the film completely, but when we get back in our positions, I know at that point, I'd stop thinking all about my character, my performance. I was like, the new dialogue was two W words in a row, and I often stammer on W's.
Yeah.
So my whole thought process was, don't fucking stutter, just get this out of your mouth, because it was just, we want you to come back or something like that, but it was the we want, and I was like, I need to get through this. So one day it went fine. Guy seemed happy. Everyone seemed happy. Because it didn't make it into film, one day I need to hit up Guy or one of his guys and find that footage. Because again, I want to see if I am just standing there just like rabbit in the headlights kind of thing. Like,
But it was fun. It was fun, that job. Huh?
It was great.
I had a great time.
Neil Maskell proper gave me some amazing words of advice. It was a really good one to work on.
Yeah, Maskell, Freddie, Craig, Jam and everyone, man. We had a great time.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah. Well, I mean, before we wrap things up, I want to go back to Bob Marley. Again, we've not touched on... I mean, you're in the biggest film of the year, maybe the decade in Barbie. So, I mean, or just quickly, this is going to sound like a weird question, but how does the process change in preparing for a film like that versus a film like playing a Bob Marley or a Malcolm X? Because tonally, it's completely different.
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you have more fun with it? Is it more relaxed? What, how's it work?
It's, you know, so the writing's funny.
So
when they say cut, oftentimes you're fucking cracking
you're
up, you know?
You're cracking up after.
I feel like really thinking about how to make a part, you know, we're talking about small parts and parts where you don't have much to say.
Yeah.
I was really thinking, how do you make him... you know, different and individual and like trying to tap into some sort of psychology that's real, however silly it is. And so I feel like Greta's main two notes were not cool. So never trying to be cool and no violence. These are not violence. These are small boys, you know.
Mm.
I don't really have any thoughts. My only thoughts really are how is Ryan feeling? He is like a big brother to me. You know, he's like the kid at school. He's like year two. I'm year two and Ryan's year six. And anything Ryan does, I feel and experience at a more intense level. So if he's feeling mad joy, I'm overjoyed. You know, if he's feeling terrified, I am like beyond terrified. And so really the process, it was making a decision to go, actually, there's no preparation after this. It's like, I have to just check what Ryan's doing. The whole thing is checking what Ryan's doing.
Yeah.
And in that way, it became really fun because I didn't know what was going on. I'm watching Ryan and I'm responding. It was kind of like slapstick in a way. And, you know, and I remember there was one scene, I think, in the battle where Ryan was, he was kind of, I think, screaming in the song. And I went, to make this consistent, I have to feel that more than him in a way, but to feel it more than him without trying to upstage.
Yeah.
You know, so I just started screaming, you know. I just started screaming. I didn't stop screaming. But what was great was that Greta was just cracking up. And if she didn't like something, it was too much. Come tell you, like, you know, chill out. That's too much. But it was really, really, really fun in that way. Like, I remember there were so many scenes where we were just having such a great time. And when he froze the mink coat off the balcony, like, they made that up on the day. They were like, this basketball Ken has just been following Ken Ryan around the whole thing. We have to kind of like connect them in a way.
He threw
the coat off and then what the coat means and all of that. So it was easier. With Barbie, it's easier to arrive at an understanding of who the character was. With Bob, I mean, the process was ongoing to the last day. I didn't ever have a moment where I felt like, I know Bob, got him. This is how I'm going to do it. I needed help from the first day of my process. I had my Jamaican friends and fam, people I count as family, come round to my house and help me translate all the way through to the last day where Bob's family and friends and Neville Garrick were there, you know, fine-tuning the language, making sure that every scene sounded and was representing Bob in the best way possible. So, you know what's great though? Doing Barbie just before Bob was the perfect thing because... no joke, I needed that fun before the intensity of that. I needed it. I didn't know I needed it, but I really needed it because, you know, Bob was, it's like nearly 2 years. And
I want to kind of highlight something you said there, because I think it's one of the most important things for actors to realise is you kind of said that finding something that makes him unique, that adds to the scene, but not at the detriment of anyone else. Because that phrase that people use in reviews a lot of this actor stole the show, I think is such a negative thing because you're not meant to be stealing the show. You're not meant to be taking oxygen. If you can add to the oxygen, if you can add to things, then that's great. But I think it...
Supporting that whole the story, idea, yeah?
Yes. So, and again, that's that you, your Ken screaming in such a manner is true to the story. It fits the scene. It adds to it, but it's not going, oh, look at me. It's kind of, it's you, as I said, you found that moment that this is perfect. It's one of the things I love about self-tapes is when I find something that I'm like, I've got something I can add here that I think is really good. I'm not being disrespectful to the text. I'm not just trying to stand out in some way, but something has come to mind that's like, that fucking works. That's a buzz for me because of not going to drama school and that. Mm-hmm. I get to do these little workshops or so on like a self-tape or whatever else. And it's finding those things, but not forcing them, and not trying to steal the show as exactly. such, because that makes you a bad member of the team.
Yeah, and it's always about story. It's always about supporting story. And that's what I've got better at over the last few years, is that actually watching things. It's not about judging yourself or being critical of your performance. It's really to ask, to have an honest conversation with yourself and go like, did I in the best way possible support the movie in that scene? And if I didn't, where could I have improved it? And then remember to do that the next time. You know, it's not about, oh, I was great in that scene, or, oh, I didn't get the emotion. Like, it's really, are we supporting the overall story and what we did scene by scene?
Yeah.
And then I think it becomes easier to watch things from, you know, an objective point of view, without going into self-loathing and you know, and all of that.
Well, I mean, I'm going to wrap things up now, and I'm going to ask two things. One, what songs have changed for you over the process of doing this? Are there songs that are now your favourite? Because again, you spoke about getting a new understanding. I think Bob has written my favourite ever protest song line in Small Axe. If you are a big tree, we are the small axe, ready to cut you down, sharpened to cut you down. I think that's just astounding. It sums everything up so beautifully. The feeling we often feel in the modern world of things are too overwhelming, or we can't be over, it's overpowering. It's like, no, a small axe can chop down a big tree. What is there anything, are there any lyrics that changed for you, or songs as a whole?
I love So Jase, and that's a song I probably didn't know before we started this process.
It was
the last song that we did in Jamaica, and it was the last song that I studied in any sort of depth. I don't know why, and it's one of the first songs Bob sings in the movie. And I would say to anyone listening to go onto YouTube and find Bob's bedroom tapes. There's a lot of recordings of Bob singing songs as he's creating them that never got released. They never got released. So there's like Jump Them and Jailbreaker, and you know, they would, a lot of that music was the music that I fell in love with, and you know, I hoped would get into the film, but I think I was just getting too into it, you know. But yeah, there's also a thing on YouTube. I'm only saying the things on YouTube because actually people can go and actually find them. There's a recording of Bob singing Waiting in Vain in his room as well, that goes on for like 17 minutes, which is just beautiful. I'd start the day. Sometimes I'll be up at 5 and I'll just play that, you know, and make a cup of tea and I'll just listen to him. I just love listening to him in that raw state, because I know a lot of the time that was first thing in the morning, and he liked it when his voice was rough, and you just get a bit of his humanity in there, you know, and he has a little bit of banter with whoever's there with him and stuff like that. And that really helped me to kind of understand him when he was creating, and the music is just,
It's a beautiful thing. And I want to once again say I loved the film, but also I loved coming here today, because as I'm walking about the hotel, people are humming Bob Marley songs, and I'm excited for the film to come out, because that is going to spread around. So to wrap things up, the big question that you're probably getting asked all the time, can you just tell me one little bit of information about your voice work on Guitar Hero Live? Hero Live. I've been looking deep into your IMDb.
I don't remember.
Really early on the Guitar Hero computer game, apparently you were a voice.
I went in and did 150 voices that were more sounds.
Oh, really?
So I don't know. It was years ago. I went in and they were like, right, we've got all of these sounds. So
it was the one that jumped out to me on IMDb. I don't know what this is.
I just did that for a couple of days. I think that's where it was. I don't think it was an actual, like, any part.
I love it. I love it. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, man. It's been a pleasure to catch up.
Yeah, nice to see you, man.
Nice one.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I hope you enjoyed that. Ain't Kingsley wonderful? This was a really good chat. It reminded me of the chat with Ed Skryne a few years back. Good few years back. I need to get Ed back on, actually. I don't know. Something about it, it just felt like there was obviously talk of acting and whatnot, but also some far, far deeper lessons in there. Or some far deeper thoughts and considerations, not even necessarily lessons, but yeah, it was great. I loved that, and I loved Bob Marley, One Love. Can't recommend it enough. Get in the cinemas and see it, please. I'll be back next week with another great episode, actually. Fantastic. Oh, it's a good one next week. They're all good at the moment. I bloody love doing this. So thank you all for supporting and for listening. I will be back next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.